You want a ghost story? It was a dark and stormy afternoon. And this Australian girl was visiting England. You know this one already? Okay, here's another one then. There was a friend of mine years ago, and he bought a nice townhouse in London, about three or four stories, and he bought it very, very cheaply. I said, why? And the agent was pretty honest with him. He said, well, people report there's a ghost in the house, because it's very old English houses, lots of ghosts. I said, really, okay, but don't believe in ghosts, so I'll take it anyway. So the very first night, you know, he got his new house. He hadn't moved his furniture and was coming the following morning, so he just got a camp bed and slept on the ground floor. In the middle of the night, he was woken up. Rap, rap. Rap, rap. He said, what's that? He thought, just imagining it. So he turned over, tried to get to sleep, and he heard it again. Rap, rap. Rap, rap. And so he got out of bed, he checked all the windows, they were all closed, the doors were closed, there's no mice, it was a very well kept house. There was no logical explanation for anything making the noise in that room. So he thought, no, it's just imagination. He turned around to go back to bed and he heard it much louder this time. Rap, 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 rap. It came from upstairs, second story. So he went upstairs, turned on the lights, looked everywhere for any scientific cause for that sound. Couldn't find anything. And he was just getting a little bit concerned by this time. But, you know, just given up. You know, imagination can play tricks on you. And then he heard it coming from the top floor. Really loud. Rap, rap! Rap, rap! And so he went up to the top floor, turned on the lights. And this time he's shaking a bit now. Because, you know, it doesn't matter, people say they're not afraid, but when supernatural things happen, you actually do get a bit scared. He checked everything in that third story, couldn't find any logical reason, anything making a noise. He was about to go downstairs, and he heard it, loudest ever, rap, rap, coming from the attic. And he didn't have any lights in the attic, so he quickly went down to get his flashlight. And there was a little ladder you can go to get up into the attic. He climbed up the ladder and he shone the flashlight in the attic, and it was full of rubbish and cobwebs and dust like attics are. And he turned it around trying to find the source of this noise. And then suddenly he heard it right behind him, loudest ever. Rap, rap! Rap, rap! And he turned around and he actually saw it. He saw it in the flashlight. It was an old piece of wrapping paper. That's a terrible joke. Wrapping paper goes rap, rap. No, that's enough. I hope that hasn't gone online overseas, has it? It has. Oh my goodness, I do apologize. People made me do that. It's not my fault. Okay. So you've got another 1 or 2 minutes before we start. I've lost a monk somewhere. Anyway, I'm sure he'll find me. He was embarrassed. He couldn't stand my humour, so it's just gone. The clouds have gone to another place. Actually, the clock says now 3 o'clock, so we may actually start now. So, we'll start with the Namo Tassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. Very good. So, as you all know, I hope by now that this is a fortnightly sutta class, second and fourth Sundays of the month outside the Range Retreat. One of the senior monks takes a sutta and discusses it, but instead of doing the suttas, most of which we've done before and are available on the internet, I am using the opportunity to read out a retranslation of the word of the Buddha. This was a document which was first printed in German, and I did some research recently, 1906, in German, and translated into English in 1907. So the translation does need to be updated. Updated for several reasons. First of all, that some of the words, the language is a bit dated, it's stilted, and it makes it hard to understand. Also, that some of the translations we can do much better than the first attempt at translating Pali words into English. And thirdly, it is something which I learned from, when I learned Pali, from Professor A.K. Warder, who's another Cambridge guy, because that means he must be okay, that he taught me, you do not translate word by word, you translate phrase by phrase, or sentence by sentence, because the unit of language is a phrase, it's not a word. So words only have meaning in the context of what goes before, what goes after them. So we never should translate, what many people do, word for word. It should be sentence for sentence or phrase by phrase. And that's what I've attempted to do here. So it is a different translation than you've had before. So far I've got reasonably good feedback that people find this much more easy to understand. It takes away much of the repetition, which you find if you read the existing translations, and it makes it a little bit more powerful because you're not distracted by things like repetition. You're not sort of distracted by words whose meaning is a bit weird or strange. We try and use ordinary words which are common in 2017. So that is the reason I'm doing this. And so far, I should mention for anyone coming for the first time, that this is based on the Buddha's teachings from the suttas. It is an anthology where we take this sutta or a part of this sutta, a part of another sutta, and we string that together along a theme, and the theme is the Four Noble Truths. And with the Four Noble Truths, we also have the last of those Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and this is where we are right now. We're just almost completing the first of the Eightfold Path called Right View. And Right View is many, many things, but here we get to that part of Right View that if one really penetrates the Right View, and here's actually what they say, a ditti pato. Ditti means the Right View, pato means achieved Right View. If you're one who's achieved Right View, then that's a simile for being a stream winner. So this is no small thing. It is the view, when it gets corrected, which makes a person a soul one, a stream winner. So this is where we are at the moment. The Sotapanna or stream winner. And this is from Majjhima Nikaya 22. I give the references so anyone can go and check up the other translations, which you may find in books by Bhikkhu Bodhi, which is much more academic. Or you can even better learn some Pali and look it up in the original, which is the best. When you contemplate in this way, and what we're doing before, the contemplating no self, when you're contemplating in this way, three fetters are abandoned in you. And the word fetter, it's what policemen put on you, like handcuffs, balls and chains. It means something which stops you moving, which stops you being free. Three fetters are abandoned in you. A view of a permanent essence, otherwise known as a soul, but to make it more accurate, an essence of this body and mind which you take to be you, which is permanent, which goes from life to life. That is a view which is abandoned, a streamlining, a permanent essence, skeptical doubt, and a belief that rites and rituals are sufficient in themselves to reach enlightenment. Those who have abandoned three fetters are all stream enterers, no longer subject to rebirth in a lower realm and headed for full enlightenment. So, the view of a permanent essence is the core of those wrong views which are overcome. The skeptical doubt, all skeptical doubt can only be overcome with direct experience. So this is not something you just believe. No, there is no self. Just like you may believe in like a Jesus or an Allah or something. This is actually a direct experience, which means all skeptical doubt, all doubt is totally abolished. And it has to be a strong experience, not just a little understanding. It's the experience which has to come when, in the Buddhist way of looking at things, the five hindrances, which are what stops and blocks our wisdom arising, when those five hindrances are overcome. Remember, the five hindrances, they call them hindrances, it's a good word. What are they hindering? Wisdom. They block it. It's like looking through a mist, or not being able to see clearly. So those hindrances, that's the purpose of deep meditation, to overcome those so you can see clearly. And of course, once it's seen clearly, with the pre or post jhana mind, then no skeptical doubt left at all. That's a very powerful experience. And also the belief that rites and rituals are sufficient in themselves to reach enlightenment. It may seem, why do we have that as a fetter, a wrong view, when most people in the Western world, we don't really do much rites and rituals, but still there are many, many people, even alive today, who still believe that by doing chanting or by doing this ritual or that rite, that you can actually say that you are a stream winner or whatever. And of course, it's not a something to be gained by a rite or a ritual, like, say, a marriage, or like, what's another rites and ritual, marriage is the best one, that, this is something which is beyond rites and rituals. It is something which comes from the deep meditations. So those are the three things which are abandoned. The most important one of them is the view of a permanent essence, a soul. And those who abandon these three fetters are all stream enterers, no longer subject to rebirth in a lower realm, which means never going to be reborn as an animal, as a hungry ghost, which goes rap-rap in the middle of the night, and never reborn in any hell realm. Even though one may have bad karma. Just like in the time of the Buddha, there's this gentleman called Angulimala, a serial killer. And he managed to avoid being reborn in lower realms as a result of his murdering. And of course, it really needs us to actually inquire the question, why? Why is like karma, which is such an important part of Buddhism, that if you do bad things, you have to pay the consequences. Why is it for stream winners, they get basically a get-out-of-jail-free card? Why? And I've mentioned this in many of the talks before. It is because, this is not here, this is Ajahn Brahm, that when you have a sense of self, you haven't seen a non-self, then you will always have guilt. It's very hard to forgive yourself when you think there is a self there. So forgiveness, it is actually based on an identity. Not forgiveness, guilt. Guilt is based on your very deep belief that there's an identity there, a being, continuous from that time you did that deed to now, which needs to be punished. This is one of the wonderful things about Buddhism. I've said this many times. We don't have punishment because the Buddha saw non-self. There's no need to punish yourself now for something you did a long time ago. There's no need, but we still do it because we still haven't penetrated non-self. Once you see this truth, that there's no permanent essence within you, then that makes it very easy to let go of the past. It's not your past, even though someone by your name perpetrated that bad deed. It overcomes guilt. And once guilt is let go of, in other words, real true forgiveness of yourself, then there's no reason to send yourself to any lower realms. And for those people who say, well, lower realms, hells and heavens, isn't that the same as these other old Abrahamic religions? Is it just a myth? When you understand what these places are, you understand why they're not a myth at all. You create your heavens and hells. They're not some place waiting for you like Bali or like London. You just travel there and there it is. You create these places. These are mind-made realms. And once you understand the power of this mind, you know, for lots of meditations, you understand how these realms are created. Created to suit you. However much you want to be punished, that's how much you will create the pain of that realm. You do it yourself. Whatever you think you need to be rewarded for, you think you've been a good person, that's how you will create your heaven accordingly. So that is why the rebirth in the lower realm is cut out for you. You don't need it anymore. And headed for full enlightenment, in how many lifetimes do you have after you become a stream winner? Nicholas, you're banned from answering this question because you know the answer. Some people say 7, some people say 6. Put your hand up for 7 more lifetimes. Put your hand up for 6 more lifetimes. Otherwise, 6 more lifetimes, you've listened to me before. Because in Buddhism, this lifetime is number 1. And so 6 more as well as this one. Just the same way that many of you who are Asian or know Asian friends, I am now, I was born in 1951 in August, so I'm now 65 years and a half in sort of Australia. But in Asia, I'm 66. This is my 66th year. So that's one of the reasons why in Asia you can always retire 1 year earlier. Drive a car 1 year earlier. Go into the pub 1 year. No, you can't do that. But they count earlier. So as soon as you're born, you're 1. So this is the same here. The way of counting means this is 1 life. You have 6 more lives after this. At most. Maximum. Now, sometimes people ask, well, what if you're a stream winner? You've only got this life plus 6 more. What happens if you decide out of compassion to actually not to have 6 more lives, but have 600 lives? What if you want to be Bodhisattva and put off your light, put off your enlightenment from here on in so that you can teach other people? Any comment? Yes, Ananda? Exactly. You can't. There's no one in there to make the choice. This is an automatic process. You can't delay it. You can't rush it. You can't do anything. It is just the same as if, like I'm going to Canberra tomorrow morning, if when I'm going to Canberra on the, I usually travel Virgin Airlines because Virgin is the appropriate airline for a monk. So when I'm travelling, suppose I ask the pilot and say, look, I've always wanted to see Ayers Rock from the air. Can you please just, you know, swooping down past Ayers Rock, just go around a few times, and just for me. Would they do that? Of course not. Because, you know, he's got a schedule. He has to go to Canberra. He can't just stop just for me. So this is the same as like trying to put off your enlightenment. At that particular time, once you're a stream winner, it's too late. You can't put off anything anymore. Your sense of self is gone. You can't control. It's too late. Whether you like it or not, 6 more lifetimes at most. Now we have, I very rarely do this, because I want to have this the word of the Buddha, but Bhikkhu Bodhi did an excellent commentary, you know, trying to bring everything together on the noble ones and the ten fetters. So I'm going to read that out now. On entering the irreversible path to attainment nirvana, that's why I say irreversible. Once you're on that path, that's it. You're on the bus, it doesn't do a U-turn. On entering the irreversible path to the attainment of nirvana, one becomes a noble person called Arya Pugala. Arya means the noble ones, Pugala means persons. I do know that in Nazi Germany, they started to take their word Aryan and give it meanings which it didn't really deserve. They even took the swastika, turned it the other way around, and used that as their symbol. So sometimes when you use the word Arya, sometimes people say, hey, what are you talking about? But Arya is a very old word, means a noble person, and in this particular case refers to a person who is a stream winner or above. And the word noble, Arya here, denoting spiritual nobility. And just to make sure that you understand why we never tell anybody, it's against our monastic rules to tell anybody who is a stream winner, who's a once-returner, non-returner, or an arahat. You know, many times you will ask me that, and you usually say, no, I can't tell you. It's kept a secret. Reason why is because we don't want to split the Sangha into the two classes. The high class, these are the stream winners and non-returners, and the riffraff. And the story is because, now honestly, that if you all know which monk in Bodhinyana Monastery, Anna, which was an arahat, which was a stream winner, which was this riffraff, suppose one of the riffraff monks was coming to give the talk, and I'm not going to listen to him, he's only riffraff. Not only that, my first year in Thailand, very bad food. One morning, a big ute came, pickup truck. In the back was full of pots and pans. You could smell it from the refectory, the delicious food they were bringing that day. And I could see it through the window and thought, wow, today I'm going to get a nice meal. You only had one meal a day, just one chance. And the driver came out and went into the halls. Those days, about 42 years ago, maybe only 50 monks, 60 monks there, including Ajahn Chah, came in and said, is Ajahn Chah here today? He wasn't. He was at somebody's house doing a blessing. So he's not here today. He said, no. Sorry. So he got in his car and drove away. He never gave us any of that food. And when you're only 23 and really hungry, that hurts. And it was just because they never thought that, you know, young monks, you know, you get much merit from all that food. Ajahn Chah, you get much more merit. You know, you invest in places where you get greater returns. And that's actually true. So that's why we never say. And that's also the old joke, because if we did say, splitting up the two monks, two types of monks, the ordinary monks and the nobility, it would create the aristocracy, the, you know, the big shots. So we don't do that. We try and keep everybody equal, everyone respected. And it's also, please do that with, you know, yourself as lay people. Don't go around telling other people, I'm a stream winner. That's nothing. I was a stream winner 2 years ago. I'm a once returner. Once with that, nothing. I'm a non-with, that's nothing. I'm an arahat, that's nothing. I've got psychic powers, that's... Don't get into that spiritual pride. So anyway, so we always keep it quiet. So it's not an attainment. Your ego, your sense of self is supposed to be diminishing, not increasing. You're seeing non-self. It's not something you're proud of. So on entering the irreversible path to attainment nirvana, one becomes a noble person, Arya Pugala. The word noble, Arya here, denoting spiritual nobility. There are four major types of noble person, and each stage is divided into two phases, the path and its fruition. In the path phase, one is said to be practicing for the attainment of a particular fruition, which one is bound to realize within that same life. In a resultant phase, one is said to be established in that fruition. Thus, the four major types of noble person actually comprise the four pairs or eight types of noble individuals. as enumerated, these are one practicing for the realization of the fruit of stream entry and the stream enterer. One practicing for the realization of the fruit of once returning and the once returner. One practicing for the realization of the fruit of non-returning and the non-returner. One practicing for arahatship and the arahat. Arahat is fully enlightened. The first seven persons are collectively known as seka, or trainees, or disciples in the higher training. Only the arahat is called the aseka, the one beyond training. Now, the reason why we say that is because any of you who do the standard chanting, you know, itipiso bhagava, when you get to the third quality of the sangha, supatipanno bhagavato sāvaka sangha, it goes on to esa bhagavato sāvaka sangha, what was it, chatari purisa yugani atta purisa pugala, the four people, the eight pairs, the four pairs, the eight people. This is where that comes from. The four pairs is the eight people. The stream winner, once returner, non-returner, arahat, and then divided into pairs of on the path, and then got to the goal. The four main stages themselves are defined in two ways. By way of the defilements eradicated by the path leading to the corresponding fruit, and by way of the destiny after death that awaits one who has realized the particular fruit. In other words, by what's been abandoned and what's going to happen to you after you die. So the stream enterer abandons the first three fetters, the view of a soul, that is, the view of a truly existent permanent essence, either as identical with the five components of existence, that's the five khandhas, or existing in some relation to the five khandhas. So basically nowhere can you find a sense of self, a permanent essence, either as identical with the five khandhas or existing in some relationship to them. The doubt about the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, and the training, and the wrong grasp of rules and observances, that is, the belief that mere external observances, particularly religious rituals and aesthetic practices, can lead to liberation. And the example of that from the suttas is the Buddha once met, this is in the Digha Nikaya, I haven't mentioned it here, once mentioned these two ascetics in India. One was the cow ascetic and one was the dog ascetic. And they say the cow ascetic went around on all fours, ate grass and slept with cows and went moo. And the dog ascetic acted like a dog. And they came up to the Buddha, they're actually quite good friends. These are human beings. If you've ever been to India, you know, you see some of the stuff which goes on there, maybe, you know, you can actually believe that. And they asked the Buddha, they said, what happens? You know, we were told that this, you know, very hard thing to do. Imagine the endurance you need to do that and survive. And he said that, what would happen to us after we die? You know, are we going to be arahats? Because we're giving up so much. And the Buddha said, please don't ask me. And when they pressed him, he said, well, if you act like that, then after death, you'll be reborn as a dog, and you'll be reborn as a cow. And that's, he didn't like that answer one at all. But people actually do those rites and rituals, thinking by such practices, they're going to get somewhere. And the stream enterer, that's what they give up. The destination is assured of attaining full enlightenment, at least in at most six more existences, which will take place either in the human realm or the heavenly worlds. The stream enterer will never undergo an eighth existence. The present existence is counted as the first, and is ever forever freed from rebirth in the three lower realms, the hells, the realm of afflicted spirits, the ghost, and the animal realm. Remember, this is Bhikkhu Bodhi. The once returner does not eradicate any new fetters. He or she has eliminated the three fetters that the stream enterer has destroyed, and additionally weakens the three unwholesome roots, wanting, aversion, and delusion. So these wanting and the ill will aversion, they've been weakened but not fully abandoned yet. So they do not arise often, and when they do arise, do not become obsessive. As the name applies, the once returner will come back to this world only one more time and then make an end of suffering. The non-returner eradicates the five basic fetters. I call them basic fetters because these are the base by which we keep getting reborn. That is, in addition to the three eliminated by the screen winterer, the non-returner eradicates two additional fetters, the desire for the five senses and anything to do with the five senses, that wanting to do with seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching is totally abandoned, and aversion. Because non-returners have eradicated desire for the five sense world, they have no ties binding them to this world. Thus they take birth in the pure abodes, Sudawasa, only for non-returners, another mind-made realm. That's all they've got left, mind. They attain final nibbana there, without ever returning to rebirth in the world of the five senses. The non-returner, however, is still bound by the five higher fetters. Attachment to jhana. And here I always say, okay, I admit this, you can be attached to jhanas, but it only means that you can't make that last step from non-returner to an arahat yet. So it's one of those attachments which is not really worth talking about at this stage. Later on, when you become a non-returner, then we can talk about that. But just be attached to the jhanas until you get there first. An attachment to the immaterial attainments, which are based on the jhanas. Now we have the conceit. The conceit here is a Pali word, it's a conception. It's not the same as the idea of conceit we have in English. It's the thought or perception, I am, sometimes arises. I am better, I am worse, I am the same. Now we go into later on, we have an example of that, which I've put in here, of what this really means. But we'll come on to that later. Restlessness and deluded thoughts or perceptions. Your views have been straightened out. These are thoughts or perceptions, which are basically old habits based on the views you had a long time ago. Those who cut off the five higher fetters have no more ties binding them to existence. These are the arahats who have destroyed all defilements and are completely liberated through final knowledge. Now I put this one in because, having said attachment to jhana is bad, only in one particular context, you know, it stops you going from that last step from being a non-returner to a full enlightenment, but it also has its advantages. And this is the jhana anagami. There is a shortcut between being a stream winner and going to enlightenment, and this is it. This is from the Anguttara. Just as in the autumn, when the sky is clear and cloudless, the sun ascending in the sky dispels all darkness from space as it shines and beams and radiates, so too when the dust-free, stainless Dhamma eye arises in you, then together with the arising of vision you abandon three fetters, the view of a permanent essence, doubt and wrong grasp of behavior and observances. As the Buddha just being a bit poetic. Afterwards, when you restrain two states, wanting and aversion, then totally secluded from the five senses, secluded from the five hindrances, you enter and dwell for a while in the first jhana, which consists of rapture and pleasure born of freedom from the five senses, accompanied by movements of mind onto the bliss and holding the bliss. Just you enter first jhana. This is the important part. If you should pass away while thus in jhana, there's no fetter bound by which you might ever return to this world. Bhikkhu Bodhi's commentary. This phrase normally denotes the attainment of non-returning. The commentary, however, identifies his disciple as a jhana non-returner, a jhana anagami. That is, a stream enterer or once returner who also attains jhana. Though such a practitioner has not yet eliminated the two fetters of sensual desire and aversion, by attaining jhana, he or she is bound to be reborn in the jhana realm and attain nibbana there, without taking another rebirth in the sense sphere. So in other words, if you're a stream winner and you get into the jhanas, there's another sutta which says you just do jhanas often or you die in a jhana, then you get promoted to being anagami. in that jhana realm which you continue on after your death, then when that fades away, so do you. That's it. You nibbana from the jhana realm. I think that's pretty cool. So, you know, it makes us sort of, once you get seen non-self, and you do lots of jhana, then basically, that's it. You die, and spend I don't know how many eons in the jhana realms, you know, blissing out, and then when it fades away, you fade away to nibbana from there. The jhana anagami. Why that happens, again, is because there's nothing to come back to. No tie. You're letting go so much that when the jhana disappears, so do you. And now, what it feels like to be a non-returner, why the sin is no self, but it's said at the top here that it has, you still have this conceit sometimes, I am, based on old habitual thoughts or perceptions. Fortunately, there is a nice sutta of this monk called Kaimaka, who was an anagami, a non-returner, and the monks asked him, basically, what it's like to be a non-returner. Why you got so far? Why can't you go the last step and become fully enlightened? And this is has the simile the Buddha uses, which I did adapt, but basically keeping the essence. It's called the scent of I am. The scent of I am. So, this is the monks talking to one of their friends, the Venerable Kaimaka. Friend Kaimaka, when you speak of this I am, what is it that you are speaking of as I am? He replies, friends, I do not speak of form, that's, you know, the rupa, as I am, nor do I speak of I am apart from the form. I do not speak of experience, vedana, as I am, nor perceptions as I am, nor volition as I am, nor of consciousnesses as I am, nor do I speak of I am apart from consciousnesses, not in sort of the five khandhas, nor outside of them. Friends, although the thought I am has not yet vanished in me in relation to these five components of existence, still I do not regard anything among them as this I am. And he gives a simile. Suppose, friend, there is a scent of a lotus. Would you be speaking rightly if you were to say the scent belongs to the petals, or the scent belongs to the stalk, or the scent belongs to the pistils? No. And how, friend, should you answer if you were to answer rightly? You should answer the scent belongs to the flower. So too, friends, I do not speak of this form as I am, nor do I speak of I am apart from form. I do not speak of experience, perception, or will or consciousness as I am, nor do I speak of I am apart from consciousnesses. Friend, although the thought I am has not yet vanished in me in relation to these five components of existence, still I do not regard anything among them as this I am. Friend, you've got another simile which is better, but down below. Friends, even though a noble disciple has abandoned the five basic fetters, still, in relation to the five components of existence, the khandhas, there still lingers in them a residual thought, I am, a desire, I am, an underlying tendency, I am, that has not yet been uprooted. Sometime later, they contemplating dependency on causes of the five components of existence, such as form, body, such is origin, such is passing away, such is experience, such is perception, such is will, such are the six consciousnesses, such is their origin, such is their passing away. As they dwell contemplating dependency on causes of the five components of existence, the residual thought I am, the desire I am, the underlying tendency I am, that has not yet been uprooted, this comes to be uprooted. And this is the killer simile which I adapted. Suppose you washed a cloth in a washing machine, rinsed it and spun it, and then put it in a dryer. Although that cloth would be clean, still it might retain the residual smell of the soap powder. Then you would hang it out in the sun to air, and after a while, the residual smell of the soap powder would vanish. In the original simile, if you read it, the washerwomen, take it to the river, and they bang it about with lye or cow dung. And that's how they used to wash things in those days. And after washing it, it would still have the smell of the lye or the cow dung. And if a simile like that, what happens is people just, the whole meaning of the simile is overwhelmed by the weird way people used to wash clothes in those days. So this is how we wash it in these days, and still keeps the essence of the simile. You've all done that, washing something in a washing machine, and after it's got the smell of the soap powder. That's like you've washed away most of the defilement, still got the smell of I am there. That's the non-returner. So too, friends, even though a noble disciple has abandoned the five love fetters and been washed clean, still in relation to the five khandhas, there still lingers in them the residual thought I am, the desire I am, an underlying tendency I am that has not yet been uprooted. But as you dwell contemplating dependency on causes of the five components of existence, the residual thought I am, the desire I am, the underlying tendency to I am that had not yet been uprooted, this comes to be uprooted. So what has happened there is the habitual tendencies. There's another simile which I was talking about, because I've seen this many times. People say you're smokers, smoke cigarettes. They know it's bad for your health. They got right view of the danger of cigarettes. They can't really get rid of it yet. And so, you know, it takes them a while until the view actually starts to penetrate into their behavior, the way they perceive and think. Totally. Otherwise, there's sometimes some lingering desire for cigarettes. But after that view of how dangerous and yucky it is really penetrates into them, then there's no way they're going to take a cigarette anymore. They've abandoned it. So once you get your view straight, you've understood something, say like alcohol is bad for you or whatever, it doesn't mean that straight away you're going to give up sort of the bad habits. They linger a while until the new view, the correct view, becomes so strong it actually washes away even the old sense or the smell of the old views, the old habits. I hope that's clear, because it's a very important point there. So I'm going to pause for a moment and see if there's any questions on what we've done so far on the stage of enlightenment. Yes.
So the stream enterer can't be reborn in a lower form, even if they've murdered somebody in a past life, because they've given up the view of self. But presumably they wouldn't kill anyone again.
Indeed, because one who's the stream winner, and this was a question, who asked me this some time ago? I think it was actually Bhante Ji. He was trying to test me out. And he asked me, he said, stream winner, can they break the five precepts? And the answer is yes. But they know straight away what they've done. So they can't hide it. They can't sort of just, no. So they still got bad habits from the past. So those bad habits from the past, it's like you've seen something, you've seen that smoking or drinking alcohol, you know, it's not good for me. But it doesn't mean you can give it up straight away. It takes a time for you to train your perceptions and thoughts.
So it has to be that realization that there is no self that kind of drains the life out of any kind of misbehavior.
It drains the life out of it. But like anything, if you're draining a tank, it takes a little while for all the water to come out. And at the very, very end, there's a little bit of water left. So if we are cleaning a water tank at Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine, yeah, that's what you have to do. You know, drain it first of all. It takes from those big water tanks, sometimes it takes a day to drain it out. And then you go in there with a sponge to get the last little bit of water with the dirt in it out. So that's a nice simile. Draining it out. Good.
Ajahn, with the jhana anagami, is that a person doing the lower four jhanas, or have to be in a rupa jhana when they die, so they actually go to that corresponding jhana realm rather than a deeper realm?
It doesn't have to be. Actually, any jhana would work. But obviously, the deeper the jhana, the faster it would be. The more letting go there is. So any jhana, this is a really amazing thing. Once you understand what the jhanas are, you can understand, wow, that's a very, very good point. Because in the jhanas is, basically in the jhanas, no sense of self you can actually feel or see. No, you just, you're gone. It's one of the reasons why, I think I mentioned this to the monks a few weeks ago, that in history there was two Catholic monks, and a monk or a nun, who went over there that looked like they were attaining the first jhana. And that was Teresa of Avila, used to levitate, and St. John of the Cross. Just reading some of what they said, it's very hard because the translation in English, don't know what they really meant to say, but it was an indication they may have got into the jhanas. But one of the reasons why they would get into first jhana is because of their methodology, their belief in total surrender, to their God. And that was 100% surrender, not keeping anything back for them. They were surrendering their will, their choice. They were letting go because of a belief, God take over. Now that, you can see that type of letting go. You can say, I can understand how that would get a person into a first jhana. But of course, the view which he had afterwards, the jhana would not be enough to break through that view. Which he didn't have any other alternative for that. But I can see just how that degree of letting go would go into that. And so when they're in that jhana state, no sense of an independent self, they would experience that as a union with God. They're gone, totally. So you can understand in the jhanas, there's no sense of me left. That's why you can't get into those states by doing stuff. That's too much of ego, too much of me doing stuff. They are literally stages of letting go, of doing will, which is why they're so still, and the me which creates all this willing. So that's why, in that such a state, you haven't totally abandoned desire and their will, but you've suppressed it so much. Now when you come out afterwards, basically, there's nothing really to get you reborn. Does that make any sense? Anything else?
So really, because doing stuff really just enhances your sense of self.
Correct.
So that's why it doesn't work.
Exactly. Thank you. I've been trying to bang at that point for about 30 years. Yes, behind you, yeah.
So if the mind punishes itself for bad things it's done, and you get reborn in the lower realms, and the same for the higher realms, what if you want to be reborn as a human?
As a human, yeah. If you want to be reborn as a human, and you have enough karma to be reborn as a human, that's what you end up as doing. It's a simile is, say you want to go to Bangladesh, Dhaka. You need to have two reasons to end up in Bangladesh. Number one, you want to go there. And number two, you've got the money and the visa. If you've got those two things, then you end up there. Well, you don't want to go there. You may have the money and the visa, but you don't want to go there. Of course, you don't end up there. If you want to go there, but you can't afford it, you don't end up there. So the wanting and the karmic wherewithal, those two come together, and that means you get reborn there. Okay. So, you got another one, okay.
I suppose you have to delete a sense of achievement as well.
Exactly. Ajahn Chah kept on saying this so many times. We meditate to let go, not to attain. Not achieving things, but to abandon things. That's why anyone who understands this stuff never thinks this is an achievement. I am a stream winner. Look at me. I am a stream winner. I am much better than you, riffraff. That's called spiritual materialism, which is very gross. And I don't know why people do that. It's because they don't really understand what's going on. There's a stage of letting go, of disappearing. That was, thank you Ajahn Bhamani, because that book, The Art of Disappearing, which is one of my favourites, some of my talks in there, he chose the title, The Art of Disappearing. I thought, wow, that's just a brilliant title. Because that's what meditation, that's what the path is, disappearing, vanishing. And that's why, when I wrote the introduction to that, the preface, I said all about that. This is about losing things, not gaining things, not attainments. So at the very end, I said, may you all get lost. And that was a compliment. I thought that the people publishing it wouldn't get it. But they got it straight away. They said, oh yeah, this is great. So they didn't delete it. So that's my wish for each one of you. May you all get lost. May you all be losers. Spiritual losers, not gainers. It's like using words in a different way, which makes it funny. Okay, so we go to free from all speculative views. So we're still on right view, okay? So this is why we're on this stuff. Then does the Buddha hold any speculative belief at all? Now, speculative belief is stuff like, you know, there are aliens. Have you ever seen an alien? You can speculate, you know, just, well, the universe is so big, there must be some somewhere. Maybe they're sitting among us. Who knows? So speculative beliefs are just things which people love to think about, even like the origin of the universe, you know, where it all began, if it did begin anywhere. It's speculation. Speculative belief is something that the Buddha has put away. For the Buddha has seen this. Just basic five khandhas, just focusing on message. Such is form, such is origin, such is disappearance, such is experience, its origin, its disappearance, such is perception, its origin, its disappearance, such is will, its origin, its disappearance, such are the consciousnesses, such their origin, such their disappearance. They're just talking about five khandhas. The fact that none of them are permanent, they arise because of other things. When those other things vanish, they all vanish. Perception, experience, consciousness, every one of them is impermanent. It arises and totally disappears for a while. Therefore, I say, with the destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up, relinquishing of all conceptual proliferations. This is one of the great words, papancha. Conceptual proliferations. Once we get an idea, it just takes off. Just, you know, like some weeds in your garden. Just like some virus, you know, in your body. Or some malware in your computer. It affects more and more. It expands. This is what it's called conceptual proliferation. Or maybe you should call it conceptual viruses. Just how they affect and just keep going and going. That's why we're thinking. There's no end to thinking. No end to philosophizing. It's conceptual proliferation. Put that away to seeing. Not thinking about this and working it all out. Seeing the basic five components of existence. Seeing that there's nothing there. So, with destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up and relinquishing of all conceptual proliferation, all philosophizing, all I-making. We make ourselves. Make this idea of a self. Mind-making. We construct the idea of possession and the underlying tendency to assuming a permanent essence. It is an underlying tendency. It's just, you know, just we've been doing this for such a long time. It's just the habit. We try and make something out of nothing. That somewhere, someplace, is a me. The Buddha is liberated through exhausting the fuel that drives rebirth. I like that translation. The fuel that drives rebirth. Your car's got no more petrol in the engines anymore. It can't move. Can't get to rebirth anymore. And that fuel is the view that there's some person in there, some essence, some mind which is not sort of permanent, is not impermanent, something, some soul, some ground of all being, something. That is becomes the fuel which makes you get rebirth, reborn. When you exhaust all that fuel, then there's no way you can make an I or a mine anymore. That's why the Buddha, no speculative views anymore, just seen through all of this. The three characteristics of existences, of existence, whether Buddha arises or not, there persists that law, that stable Dharma, that fixed course of Dharma. All phenomena that arise from a cause are impermanent. Suffering are not a permanent essence. All phenomena that arise from a cause are impermanent. In other words, they arise from a cause, then they must be able to disappear. And the suffering, not a permanent essence. The Buddha awakens to this and breaks through to it, and then explains it, teaches it, proclaims it, and establishes it, discloses it, analyzes it, and elucidates it. In other words, that's actually Nietzsche. That's not Anicca, that is Nietzsche. The law persists. Now, what is it that the wise in the world agree upon as not existing, or which I too say that it does not exist? Any form, body that is permanent, stable and eternal, not subject to change. This the wise in the world agree upon as not existing, and I too say that it does not exist. Any experience, perception, volition, any type of consciousness that is permanent, stable and eternal, not subject to change. This the wise in the world agree upon as not existing, and I too say it does not exist. It is impossible and inconceivable, said the Buddha, that a person who is enlightened, or even on the path of being enlightened, could consider any phenomena that arise from a cause as permanent, as pleasurable, and as a soul. No such possibility. There is a possibility that an unenlightened worldling might consider some phenomena that arise from a cause as permanent, as pleasurable, and as a soul. There is such a possibility. This is where we make a soul, an original being, a ground of all being, an essence, anything. It is the tendency of human beings to do that, to find an ultimate retirement home for you. Therefore, any kind of form whatsoever, any kind of experience whatsoever, any kind of perception whatsoever, any kind of will whatsoever, any kind of consciousness or jitter or mind whatsoever, because those three are synonyms, whether past, future or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all form, all experience, all perception, all will, all mind, should be seen as it really is with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not my permanent essence. And now, one of my favorite quotes. This is so short, this is not what the Buddha said. We put it in here anyway, because it's really cool. This is very famous from the Visuddhimagga. Mere suffering exists. No sufferer is found. The deed is, but no doer of the deed is there. You have to understand this, that is where the you don't need to have any punishment. The deed is, but not the doer. Nibbana is, but not the person who enters it. Not a being, not a mind, not you. Nibbana, everything gone. And last, the path is, but no traveller on it is seen. In other words, if you travel the Eightfold Path, you get nowhere. You have to disappear. And then the path becomes as wide as a 20-lane highway. Even wider. You can't miss it. But when you are traveling that path, when you are doing the meditation, you are doing sort of whatever, then the path disappears. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Nibbana is, but you don't attain it. You don't enter it. You can't. You have to disappear and vanish. And the more you vanish, the closer you get. I love that. Anyway, any questions? Yes, John. Yeah, go on.
The Sotapanna, you know, after they have no self, they don't commit themselves to any punishment for what they did.
Yeah. Good.
But in the case of someone killing a Sotapanna, in a hypothetical example, Sotapanna killing another person,
yeah,
regardless if they create their hell or not, they've still got that karma to receive, don't they?
Ah, have they? They've got some karma there. You know, if a stream winner or a once return or something kills someone, you go to jail. Yeah, you can't just say, you can't use that as a legal defence in Australia. It says in the suttas that stream winners are no subject to such punishments. That doesn't wash in a jury trial or a judge trial. But no, so there is some consequences there, but those consequences don't arise in a future life. Anguri Mala, apparently, that, you know, he did, people threw stones at him and scolded him, so he did get some sort of suffering as a result of what he did, but no future life suffering. So you're not punishing yourself. Other people punish you, but not you.
So could the Sotapanna then reborn for the first life of seven or six, I should say, reborn into unsatisfactory life for period of time from that karma?
Not at all. The reason is because no one sends you to your next destination. You send yourself there. You choose, literally, where you're going to go next. But sometimes we do make stupid choices. We're not wise. Because people feel they deserve to be punished. Even in this life, ask any psychologist. People with a strong sense of guilt will actually deny themselves happiness or success.
But doesn't the karma actually pull, would even pull a Sotapanna to that?
No, the karma is very personal. You are the owner of your karma. In many ways. Okay. Good one. Yes, because she's that a few. Go on.
What exactly is meant by consciousness is?
Consciousness is, I added the plural there, because this is translating according to the definition. Whenever Buddha ever uses the word vijnana, he says there are six types of vijnana: sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and knowing. The mind, the citta. These are the six consciousnesses. And I use that plural because it makes the word much more powerful. This is not me changing Buddhism. This is using a word and translating it according to its meaning. Six different types. And that changes the whole ball game. Not consciousness, because so often people say conscious, that's me, that's my essence. There's six different types of them. Which one is you? Said the Buddha. And then you find out, when there's one there, the others are gone. They arise according to causes. Consciousness. And that sixth consciousness, mind, its synonym is citta, the mind. Each one of these consciousnesses arises because of a cause. When that cause disappears, the citta vanishes. That's the third satipatthana. To see the rise and fall of the citta. Rise and fall means gone, disappear. So it cannot be a permanent thing. And what I just read out here, all types of consciousnesses, which includes all types of citta, should be seen, whether it's past, future or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all consciousnesses, which include all mind, all jitta, should be seen as it truly is. Not me, not mine, not a self. And that is just the requirement for being an Arya, for being a stream winner. Without that, you're not a stream winner. So there's another one from...
Sorry, Ajahn.
Yeah.
Because John was saying, doesn't karma cause itself?
Yeah.
And it just occurs to me that the self, the sense of self, is a bit like a black hole. It is exerting huge power, and it's creating everything, including hell realms and everything you can think of. And without the self, everything just melts away, and there isn't any attraction.
Is that yes, indeed. That's the whole point of this, to have you melt away. The whole point of this, Sue, is to get rid of you. Get rid of Sue, the sense of self, the sense of me. It's to lose things, not to gain things. Not to enhance yourself by, you know, just by being called a saint and just look how great I am. You want to? Okay, over there.
So what is being reborn? Some form of energy that's being discharged into the air at the time of?
No, it's not energy. There's nothing continuing from one moment to another. It is cause and effect. We're going to go into that in a few moments because I was just scrolling down. We've got dependent origination coming soon, which is how the Buddha would answer your question. But we'll just go on a bit further here because time is running out. Okay, we've gone here. Oh yes, it's Yamaka. Sutta Nipata 44, after the path is not travelled on, it is seen. It is those who do not understand form as it really is, who do not know and see its origin, its cessation, and the way leading to its cessation, that think an enlightened one, an arahat, exists after death or does not exist after death, or both exists and does not exist after death, or neither exists nor not, does not exist after death. It is those who do not see experience as it really is, who do not know and see perception as it really is, who do not know and see will as it really is, who do not know and see the consciousnesses, including mind, including citta, as they really are, who do not know and see their origin, their cessation, and the way leading to their cessation. These are the people who think an arahat or an enlightened one exists after death, or does not exist after death, or both exist and does not exist after death, or neither exists nor does not exist after death. This is one of the questions, what happens to an arahat after they die? And this is the beginning of one of the best answers, clearest answers. For one who knows and sees the five components of existence, the five khandhas as they really are, who knows and sees where they come from, their origin, according to causes, their cessation, causes stop, these things vanish, and the way leading to the cessation, they do not think either of these possibilities. They don't even think an enlightened one exists after death or does not exist after death, or both exist and does not exist after death, or neither exists nor does not exist after death. And this is the really beautiful sutta. What do you think? This is from the Samyutta Nikaya, the Kanda Samyutta. What do you think, Yamaka? Asked Sariputta. Do you regard the body, experience, perception, will, or consciousness as an enlightened one? No, Venerable. Do you regard an enlightened one as in the body, as in experience, as in perception, as in will, or as in consciousness? Is somehow contained in these five khandhas? No, Venerable. Do you regard an enlightened one as apart from the body, something separate, as apart from experience, as apart from perception, as apart from will, as apart from consciousnesses, like as apart from the mind, as apart from the five khandhas? Is the enlightened one something separate from the five khandhas? No, Venerable. Do you regard the body, experience, perception, will, and consciousness all taken together as an enlightened one? No, Venerable. Do you take an enlightened one as one who's without a body, without experience, without perception, without ill will, without any consciousness? No, Venerable. But Yamaka, when an enlightened one, especially the Buddha, is right in front of you, when an enlightened one is not apprehended by you as real and actual here in this very life, is it fitting for you to declare that an enlightened one is annihilated and perishes with the breakup of the body and does not exist after death? It's not annihilated, there's nothing here now, it's just a process here now. So you can't see anything there, any essence, any enlightened essence there, either as any one of those five khandhas, as in those five khandhas, as apart from those five khandhas, as five khandhas taken together. So, if Yamaka, they were to ask you, what happens to an enlightened one with the breakup of their body after death? What happens to an arahat when they die? I would answer that the body is impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering has ceased and passed away. That's all. Experience is impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering has ceased and passed away. Perception is impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering has ceased and passed away. Will is impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering has ceased and passed away. Consciousness is each one of them, like chitta, like the mind is impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering has ceased and passed away. The process has just stopped. Nothing being enlightened. Nothing being annihilated, sorry. It's just a process stopped. Good, Yamaka, good, says Sariputta. That's one of the most powerful teachings of the fact about when people say, you know, is there something outside the five khandhas which you can, outside the five components of existence, which you can take to be your essential self? Very clear. The answer, of course, is no. So the Buddha was very, very clever, smart, to cut off all possible angles of escape. People always like to find a loophole where they can exist. Fortunately, the Buddha was too smart for you. If there is the view, the soul and the body are the same, there is no living of the holy life. The reason is because once you die, then the soul dies anyway, so what's the point of this? If you have the view, the soul is one thing, the body is another, there is no living of the holy life. Because it doesn't even matter what you do, the soul is just independent of you. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Buddha teaches the Dharma by the middle, dependent origination and dependent cessation. So I remember once reading the Bhagavad Gita as a young student, and there I think it was Krishna talking to Arjuna, and Arjuna was, you know, not wanting to go into battle to fight because he was going to kill people. And Krishna was saying, you're not killing anybody, you're just killing bodies, that's all. No soul, I mean the soul is totally independent, you can't sort of stop a soul with a sword. So, you know, that actually put me off Hinduism because there's no real... Well, you can't really kill anybody because, you know, the soul is indestructible. So that doesn't make any sense to me. But anyway, that's really putting down Hinduism because that's only one tiny part of it. But I remember that as something which I could never accept. If the soul was totally independent of the body, it doesn't matter what you do. You can't ever kill a soul or harm it or hurt it. It's independent. So there's no real holy life, the Buddha is saying here. So if the soul is one thing, the body is another. Or there is, the soul and the body are the same. There's no living of the holy life. Not veering to either of those extremes, a third way, the Buddha teaches the Dhamma by the middle, dependent origination and dependent cessation. And this is another definition of the right view. One who sees dependent origination and cessation sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. So it's not just... Now, you can say sort of seeing non-self, but what is it that we take to be this self? And this is where dependent origination comes in. And this is, of course, answers your question about, you know, how rebirth can happen. Nothing getting reborn, not energy, but cause and effect. With delusion as a cause, volition comes to be. especially the delusion of me. As long as there's a me, then I do stuff. When you disappear, your will goes. Because your will, the doer, volition, that is just a sign of a me. There's always a me behind it. With volition as a cause comes the consciousnesses, and this will always has to be in your future life. With consciousness as a cause, the objects of consciousness come. These are the sheaves of reeds, similarly. The way that farmers in the old days would dry the reeds or the hay, they would make a sheaf, two sheaves of hay, and lean them up against each other. You take one away, the other one falls down. So objects of consciousness and consciousness, they have to come together. If there's no objects of consciousness, the consciousness vanishes. If there's no objects of the mind, the citta vanishes, disappears. That's in the Nidana Samyutta. With name and form as the cause, objects get the six sense bases. The six sense bases, sensory contact. Sensory contact causes experience. Now this is not the sense of, you know, A leads to B and then a few seconds later then C. These things always have to be there together. And with experience as the cause, wanting, and with wanting causes the fuel, the upadana. And with fuel as a cause, the states of existence, which I mentioned, you create these. With some place to go to, you cause rebirth. And with rebirth as a cause, aging and death, sorrow, crying, pain, unhappiness and distress comes to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. No god nor Brahma can be called the maker of life. Empty phenomena roll on, dependent on conditions all. It's rolling on, cause and effect, empty conditions. No being, no energy, nothing there, empty conditions. But when a meditator has abandoned delusion and arouses true knowledge, then with the fading away of delusion and the arising of true knowledge, you do not generate a meritorious volition or a demeritorious volition, not even a neutral volition. You don't generate anything because there's no one there to do the generation. So, the arising of true knowledge. And sometimes I've heard that some people say, oh, dependent origination, it's cut at the gap between this and that. And that's just so much go-mayang. Remember the word go-mayang? Go-mayang. Go is the ball. Mayang is what comes out the back end of a ball. And there's never, Buddha never says that at all. It's always delusion. When that is abandoned, that's when this causal sequence gets stopped. The mindless fading away cessation of delusion comes a cessation of will. Ooh, that's powerful. When you realize there's no one there, then actually you can stop the will. Beforehand, you suppress the will. When you see there's no one there, there's nothing to do the willing anymore. That's one of the reasons why a stream winner can't get reborn that many times. The will is gone. With a cessation of will, cessation of consciousness in your next life. Nothing to get you reborn. Cessation of consciousness, the objects of consciousness disappear, sense bases, sensory contact, experience, wanting, fuel, state of existence, rebirth, the whole thing stops. House builder. This is in the Theragata. Many monks, nuns, use this phrase. House builder, you have now been seen. You shall build no houses again. Your rafters have been broken and your gables all torn. Thrown off course, the jitta will be destroyed right here. Without any doubt, jitta, you shall be destroyed. That's the mind, the house builder. Once you've seen that, it's not who you are. It's just empty phenomena rolling on your mind, the jitta. That's from the Theragata. House builder, you've now been seen. You shall build no houses again. Your rafters have been broken, your gables all torn. Thrown off course, the jitta will be destroyed right here. Theragata. That was your house builder. no more rebirth. Whew. Okay, that's actually come to a nice stop. That's the end with a really big bang of right view, according to the word of the Buddha. Okay, looks like we've got some questions from overseas, so let's deal with those before I ask any more questions from here. Here we go. From Malaysia to Ajahn. Is there any distinction between making merit and karma? Karma includes making merit and making bad karma as well. So karma, you can make good merit, you can make... you can make sort of bad merit for yourself. Making merit is like good karma. So good karma is merit, bad karma is demerit. Okay, thank you. Demerit's okay. They have that over here because you have demerits when you have long weekends and you get double demerits. So basically karma is just how merits and demerits are made. From Santa Barbara, is there a way to get rid of the result of bad karma through education, understanding, or suffering is necessary? For a bit of faith, you can lessen the results of bad karma. And, you know, I don't like to say this, but the Buddha said it, so I have to admit it. The other way of overcoming bad karma is not overcoming it, but diluting it. And I mean, the reason I don't like saying this, because many sort of monks and places use this as a great way to raise funds. And sometimes monks and monasteries get too rich. And especially that one in Thailand, which is being shut down now at last. But yes, the Buddha said in the simile of salt, if you take a tableful of salt and you put it in my glass of water and you stir it up, it means you can't drink the whole glass, it's so salty. But if you put it in a rainwater tank, in 1,000 liters, and you stir it up, and then you drink that water, you can hardly taste it because it's really dilute. And the Buddha said it's the same with bad karma. If you've got a certain amount of bad karma, you've only got a little bit of good karma, you're going to really taste that bad karma. But if you dilute it, by making lots of good karma, then you won't even taste it. So unscrupulous monks, he's done some bad karma. Well, I think that's like $1,000 to the nuns' monastery, and that will probably dilute it. It just opens the door to really unscrupulous practices. So that's why, just do good karma anyway, not just to abandon the bad karma. And some people do that, you know, they sort of go out on a Saturday night, and they come to the temple on the Sunday morning to dilute the bad karma they did on a Saturday night. That's really just a bit unscrupulous. But it's true. You can not get rid but dilute the result of bad karma by doing a lot of good karma. But the best way is actually just to become a stream winner. And lastly from Penang, can a person know for sure he or she is a Sotapanna? That is a wonderful question. There's a lot of people, you can know a person is not a stream winner. You can't know if a person is. So many people get deluded. They want to be a stream winner or a once returner or a non-returner so much that they just delude themselves. The desire, the craving is one of the five hindrances, and that means they don't see things that clearly. The monks know this story. I went to see this great monk, Ajahn Tate, many years ago, and I had to wait in line. And as I was waiting, he was talking to this other Indonesian girl, very, very wealthy. And, you know, she was talking about her meditation. She said, I was meditating, and, you know, my mind went so still, went blank, things disappeared. That was fourth jhana, wasn't it? And Ajahn Tate said, no, it wasn't. You were just, you know, sleepy. And they said, but, you know, this is what happened first of all. And then it was fourth jhana, wasn't it? And she asked again. She said, no, no, no. And then he asked again. And he asked about four or five times. It was fourth jhana, wasn't it? She said, no, 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 no. And then I was listening to this. And she asked again. And he said, ugh. And she smiled and went out. And she told everybody afterwards, my jhana has been confirmed. Now Ajahn Tate said, ugh. And that means, yeah, it was true. And I saw that, you know, and this is one of the problems, is that people want these things so much that they want it confirmed by somebody else. And even as one sutta where Ananda asked the Buddha, all these people who come up to you, the greatest teacher, who they have faith in, and they claim to be stream winners, once returners, non-returner, arahats, are they all those attainments, are they all true? And the Buddha said, some are, some aren't. And I read from that, even the Buddha couldn't convince a person they were deluded. So that's just how powerful these delusions can be. People can think they're a stream winner, once returner, even an arahat. Not even a Buddha could dislodge that from them. It's the power of the sense of self. Creates, manipulates, and just anything else they would just push aside as, no, I'm still a stream winner, I'm still a once returner. So it's very dangerous. Which is one of the reasons why, that number one, you don't tell people about your attainments because they could be wrong. Number two, check them out. You know, from what the Buddha said, you know, this is the only real place you can actually get some authority. Not from me, not from any other monk or nun, but from this, how the Buddha taught. You know, basic thing, a stream winner that can't have a sense of self. It's much easier to see if a person's an anagami or not, a non-returner, because non-returners don't have any lust or ill will. You cannot make a non-returner angry, which is one of the reasons we test people. And if anybody says they are a non-returner, you know, say Mahesha was just laughing over there. You know, I think I told you this before, Mahesha. If you tell me you're an anagami, I would say, no way can a Sri Lankan girl become a non-returner. That's impossible. Maybe in your next life when you become a boy, then you can. Now, of course, you know me, I don't believe in that sort of stuff. But I say that just to try and irritate her. Get her upset, find her weak points. And if she comes, what are you, misogynist? I believed in you, I thought you regarded everybody equal, that you're a modern monk, you failed a test. So you find people's weak points and try and make them angry. And if they do get angry, yeah, test has been concluded. And I don't mind these days, because you should find these things out yourself. For a stream winner, now, there is a little test. It's in one of the commentaries. I had to read this because if a monk or a bhikkhuni say they're a stream winner and they're not, it can be like a capital offence. Now, they have to be disrobed. Now, if they know that they're lying, if they're just boasting it and they're not. So that sometimes, we have to find out, are they not? So there's a little test. On one of those tests, two questions you have to ask for being a stream winner is when and where did it happen? When? What time of the day? Where? What were you doing? Because it's an event. It's not something you just grows on you and think, I just have faith in non-self now. Don't exactly know when it happened, but yeah, just I understand it now. It is an event, stream winning. And that's a powerful thing to know. So I've blown it with you guys now. Because if you do want to sort of fake stream winning, you say, no, it happened at Dhammaloka Center when Ajahn Bom was doing the sutta class. So there's other ways to find that out. So yeah, that's how you can know for sure. When did it happen? Where did it happen? And have it, honestly, check it out with the suttas. Is there any idea that there's a self which is going to, a jitter, an essence, anything which will survive the death of an arahat? Okay, so that actually finishes good. I wanted to finish a bit early because it's full moon day today. I'm going to go back to the monastery for the Patimokkha ceremony, and also early tomorrow morning I'm going to Sydney. Sorry, not Sydney, to Canberra. But coming up next is the second factor, which you can see on the board there, is not right intention, but I'm calling it right motivation. And I'm sticking by this as the word sankapa. And it is explained, or it's translated, by how it is defined. Not by its etymology. In other words, you take the word and you split it up or see how it's used in other places. By how it's used in this particular function as being number two in the Eightfold Path. The right motivation. And that actually opens up the Eightfold Path in a much more interesting understanding. But that will come in a couple of weeks or maybe 4 weeks' time, because I think it'll be in Hong Kong. Yeah, probably Hong Kong in the 2 weeks' time. But this is what's coming next. So now finish with right view. So I hope you enjoyed that. It is put online. So if you want to go over it afterwards, you can record, get online and listen to it online again and just get more into it. Thank you for listening. Let's now. Okay, now we can now pay respects to the Buddha.